Good morning.
Good morning.
Let's begin with just a couple of minutes of quiet sitting. Thank you. Well, it's nice to see everyone this morning. It's nice to be here. I wasn't here last week. I was out on the West Coast. I was attending a Zen Teachers Conference near Portland. I went there along with Rosemary, who is here, and Susan Nelson, who is not here. I think she's flying back from Seattle today. And it was quite an adventure, and I'll tell you a little more about that later. But first, I'd like to note that we're in the midst of fall practice period now. It's something I'm leading with Busho. Practice period is something that grew out of the Buddha's practice. During the rainy season in India, he and his monks would withdraw to a single place. Instead of wandering around teaching, they would stay in one place and they would all practice together rather intensively. And we can't really do that here because this is not a monastery and we all have busy lives. But what we can do is we can all come together and support each other a couple of times a year, spring and fall, for about an eight-week period and practice a little more deliberately, maybe a little more intensively. So we have about 25 or 30 people doing this. It's either Wednesday evening or Thursday morning. And when you take part in practice period, as many of you know, you agree to do certain things like you do a certain amount of sitting on a regular basis. You do some work practice, at least one retreat day or maybe a half day. You work with a practice buddy. You do some reading and you discuss a book. And our book this fall is something called Appreciate Your Life by Taizen Maizumi Roshi, who is a Zen teacher from L.A. And this morning I'm going to talk about one chapter from this book. And this is going to be an expansion of what we're talking about in practice period. So if you're in practice period, there should not be very much repetition, maybe just one story, and I hope you'll indulge me in that. And in return, I'll make sure that you have a head start on one of the discussion questions this week, because basically I'm going to answer one of my own questions. So the chapter I'd like to talk about is called Do It Over and Over and Over. And when I read that chapter title, I was immediately drawn to it in kind of a negative way, if you know what I mean, because I thought it captured one aspect of our Zazen, which is maybe not always so pleasant, not always so wonderful. I mean, Zazen can be this, Zazen can be that. You never know what Zazen is going to be, even moment to moment. You don't know what it's going to be. But sometimes, and I think if you've meditated at all, you've probably experienced this, it can be just kind of repetitive. It can get tedious sometimes. Our basic instruction here at Zen Center is to follow the breath. And I usually explain in introductory meditation that the thing to do is to sit very quietly and focus on the breath, which doesn't mean thinking about the breath or trying to do anything particular with the breath, but just have that experience of breathing. Focus on that experience of breathing. And it's really not about words. It's just being there. And if thoughts come in, you kind of acknowledge you're having a thought and you let the thought go. You come back to the breath. You don't push the thought away so much as you choose not to go there. You choose gently to come back to your breath. And this is something that you may need to do over and over and over again. And when we begin a serious practice, we tend to see how busy our minds are. I mean, they are really busy. Sometimes we sit and it seems like we're not meditating at all. We're just watching this crazy show that's going on. So in order to quiet the mind, we have to come back to the breath over and over and over. And it takes some effort. And it takes some patience. And this is just a situation that we have to accept. It's just part of the deal. If we're going to do this practice in order to improve things for ourselves and for all beings, there are going to be these times where it's just going to kind of be hard work. That's the way it works, and there's no way around it. It's kind of, you know, this is part of being an adult, accepting that things are not always going to be the way we want them to be, and moving forward despite that, and doing what needs to be done, whether it's pleasant or not. But here's the thing, it's not always like that, right? Zazen is not always like that. Not by a long shot. And that's the point that my Zumi makes. He actually spends very little time in this chapter talking about the tedium, although it's suggested in the chapter. But he actually explains, do it over and over and over in a way that brings a real freshness and excitement to meditation. So in this chapter, he quotes Dogen Zenji's very well-known statement in the Genjo Koan, which some of you have probably heard many times, to study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be enlightened by the 10,000 dharmas. To be enlightened by the 10,000 dharmas is to free one's body and mind and those of others. So there's a lot going on there, and many talks have been written about just these four lines. But the thing that my Zumi focuses on in this chapter is that word study. It's commonly translated as study, and that word is, in Japanese, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing this correctly, narau, N-A-R-A-U. And that word, he says, in Japanese, doesn't exactly mean study. It means more like to repeat something over and over and over. So to study the self is to do something over and over and over regarding the self. It's more like, we could also say learn, but it's not really about learning something new. It's more like practice. And that's practice, not in the sense of doing it again and again until we get it right. Like now I'm doing it in kind of a poor way, and later on I'll do it in a way that really works. It's practice in the sense of doing our Zen practice, which is just living our life. That's all it is, just living our life. He says, this seemingly repetitive process is nothing but one's own life. He says, our Zazen is not just learning something over and over. Rather, as Dogen Zenji says, it is realization itself. Zazen is realization itself. In other words, we do not separate practice and realization. We do not practice for the sake of realization. Realization is already here. It's already here. So we're not doing it over and over and over to get better at it. We're doing it over and over and over in order to be right here, to be with it the way it is right now, over and over again. So each moment is fresh. This is very different from tedium. This is the opposite of tedium. It can't be tedious because it's new each time. But we are both enlightened and deluded beings, you could say, at the same time. The enlightenment is here, and we are Buddha already. but we cannot always see that. Our delusions and our desires mask the Buddha in us. And so the deluded part of us sometimes has to do it over and over in that tedious way, just doing the work. And the enlightened part of us is doing it over and over in the sense that each moment is fresh. Sometimes one aspect seems to be in charge, sometimes the other. I think they're both going on at once, actually. So, as I was reading this chapter, I needed to come up with a study question for the practice period that people would think about while they were doing their reading and maybe discuss with their partner, practice partner, or maybe discuss in the small groups during our meeting. And I came up with a question, and this is what I asked. Do it over and over and over might sound like a process involving boring repetition or like doing the same thing again and again poorly in hopes of perfecting it. Is Zazen sometimes like that? Is Zazen sometimes not like that? I'm kind of hoping for a yes to this last question. How can a person practice in such a way that Zazen stays fresh? And it's going to be interesting to see what kind of answers people come up with, and I think we'll probably have a range. I'm thinking the thing that occurred to me first was that we can keep Zazen fresh by maintaining a spirit of openness. I'm thinking that maybe that's the most important thing. Zazen is a moment-to-moment process. Openness is a moment-to-moment process. We may have a moment in Zazen where we're acknowledging that we're having a thought and we're bringing our mind back to our breath, and the thing is to do that and to just let it be. That means that when we come back to our breath, it's a new moment. All of the past is gone. We may have had to discipline our mind in that last moment. We may have been talking to ourselves, saying, come back, let that go. But there is no reason whatsoever to think that we are going to need to discipline our mind in this moment as well. It's a completely new moment. A new moment in which we can manifest ourselves as realization, as Maizumi says. At least there's that potential every moment. So it's like hitting the refresh button on the computer, right? Refresh. And the question is, do we have a refresh button? Can we actually encourage ourselves in such a way that we refresh our practice? It's great to say, well, you should be open to the moment, and we can strive to do that, but are there practical steps we can take? And this is kind of my subject today. I was thinking about this question, and an approach to talking about it came to me pretty suddenly, because at the time I was thinking about this, as luck would have it, I was really feeling quite refreshed after my trip to the West Coast. I mean, I was feeling really refreshed. Really good. And this is not something I expected. Because I've been doing things like retreats and Buddhist gatherings and stuff for long enough that I think I have finally learned to go into them without expectations. Because those expectations can just mess you up, you know. You go to the retreat and think, okay, this is it, now or never. Enlightenment or bust, you know. And so you want this thing, and you spend the whole retreat wanting this thing, and you're not even there at all. You're off in the future with this thing you want. So I went into this conference with really no expectations, and I thought, okay, I'll go, I'll do the thing, I'll see what happens. It was kind of a surprise. So as I flew home Monday, I was working on the plane on my first practice period talk, and it felt pretty good. I was enjoying working on the talk. It didn't feel like work. It felt nice, even though planes can be kind of uncomfortable. And then Monday night, I was hanging out with my wife, Monday evening, that is, and each day since then, I've gotten up early, and I put in a good day's work. I go to my job, and I put in a good day's work, and I work on my Zen Center stuff, and I've been able to do this without feeling put upon or feeling rushed or feeling that I have deadlines. I mean, maybe a little bit, but for the most part, it's just been this process of doing one thing at a time, being absorbed in that thing, and enjoying it. So I don't really get tired. And it's been a great week. It's been a great week. Because sometimes I do get a little tired. And I think this is actually about the best thing that can happen. I mean, I like things like vacations, and I love hanging out with my wife and with friends and having fun. And I like to travel, you know, and all of that stuff is great. But on a day-to-day basis, what is better than just feeling really good and being really productive and getting a whole lot of stuff done and feeling like you're making sort of, your actions are good for everyone around you and you're making progress and stuff. I just love that. And as you may know, I just love this work. I love this practice of Zen meditation, and I love sharing it. And I believe that, besides taking good care of the people around me and really paying attention to them and really focusing on them and giving them time, this is the best thing I can possibly do to make the world a better place for myself and for others, this practice. So, am I lucky or what? I'm just where I want to be. So I thought that if I asked myself how it was that I came to feel so refreshed from this trip, perhaps I would find an answer about refreshing practice in general, an answer that might apply to other situations. So I'll see if I can do that. But first I'd like to give you a little background on the conference, just so you know what the setting was. So the conference was held by the Soto Zen Buddhist Association, the SZBA, and that's an association of teachers in our tradition, which is Japanese Soto Zen. And the SZBA has developed standards for the training of priests, and we incorporate those standards here. It's a very lengthy document about expectations of priests in various areas of serving the community and study and practice and things like that. So our center, MZMC, is an independent entity, but there's a great benefit, I think, in linking up to this larger body and following their guidelines. It's kind of an added layer of accountability, and it helps promote consistency in practice from one center to another. And if you've ever gone to another center and seen the little differences and the little samenesses, I think you probably appreciate that. So attendance at this conference had to be capped at 100. There were 102 people on the list that I have, because there wasn't enough physical space for more people. They had to turn people away, which is a good sign. Nonetheless, there were 12 teachers there from Minnesota. So that's about 12% of the participants. And I know you shouldn't be too proud, but I was really proud of that. I think we made a good showing. And I counted up the list. And the most people at the conference came from California, not surprising. Second most from Oregon, not surprising, that's where the conference was held. And third most was Minnesota, which I thought was pretty cool. And people really noticed this, and they said, I can't turn around without bumping into a Minnesotan. What's going on here? And I said, well, there was this guy, Katagiri, and he came out here 40 years ago. Some people brought him in, and he was very sincere, and he worked very hard. And he ordained people, and they founded centers, and they ordained other people, and now I think there are over 60 people in his lineage, this one guy. And so it's really fantastic. So I also looked at that list, and I noted they listed whether people were male or female, because you can't always tell by their Dharma names. Out of 102 participants, 54 of them were women, and 48 were men. So there were a majority of women at a very high level, kind of organizationally. And I think that's really wonderful. I think that's a really good sign. And the conference was held at Great Vow Monastery, which is in a rural area near the Columbia River, northwest of Portland. And it's huge, or at least it seemed huge to me. It's a converted elementary school, and it's a residential facility, so there are many practitioners living there on the site. It has a lot of dormitories for visitors and a commercial kitchen and an enormous zendo, meeting places, gardens, and this most incredible, beautiful forest. It's really nice. And there's a Jizo garden in the forest that is just, I think, indescribable. You just have to see it. But I will try to describe it. It's right next to the monastery, and it's at the edge of the forest, and you go in through this kind of beautiful, elaborate Asian-type gate, And you see there's a sidewalk with some stones set kind of, not randomly, but set into the concrete just here and there. And you know right away that people are taking good care of this stuff and being deliberate. And you walk up some steps and you go into the forest. And this forest is incredible. It's a rainforest, really. There are Douglas firs and red cedar trees, which are very tall, and other kinds of trees like maples and things, and moss everywhere. It's kind of dry now, and it didn't rain while we were out there. You know, and you touch the moss, and it's kind of almost crinkly. But still, it's there everywhere. And the first thing I noticed upon stepping into the forest was the smell of decay, this strong smell. And I don't mean that in a negative way. I mean, it's a strong, beautiful smell, but just so kind of powerful and verdant, you know. And you walk into this forest, and there are little paths there, and it's devoted to Jizo. And Jizo is a bodhisattva. We have a Jizo figure out here in the back. If you take the sidewalk out to the alley, you'll see a standing Jizo to your right. And we also have a small one upstairs on the third floor. And Jizo is usually portrayed as a monk, just a simple monk holding a staff with some little rings on it. And the purpose of the rings is to warn animals as he's approaching so they can avoid harm to each other. He is sometimes portrayed as a sort of little kind of round-headed, cute little guy, and sometimes very sort of naturalistic. And he's sort of the guardian of women, children, and travelers. And he also is especially caring about people in the hell realms, people who are having a really hard time. And he goes into hell and he brings them back. So this is a beautiful figure. And so they have these little Jizo figures all over along these paths. And there must be dozens or maybe hundreds. I think hundreds, don't you? Yeah, and all different types. And so all of them are kind of personalized in some way. They're wearing a little rakasu, or they've got some little decoration, or there's moss growing on their head or something. Many different types. And people have set up little altars there, and there are memorials to children who have died and adults who have died. And I don't know, just so profoundly moving to be there, you know. And I kept going back there again and again, and I think a lot of people did. It's a sacred place. So Jizo is kind of a special thing for them out there, and that's really lovely. So, and this was a conference, so I went to events and I learned about things, rituals, academic approaches to Buddhism, things like that. We had discussions about developing standards for SZBA membership, so these are big meetings, everyone's least favorite part. But that's part of the deal, you know, you need to do the meetings. And then at the end, we had this Dharma Heritage Ceremony, and this is the part I talked about in practice period. So if you come to this and you're a transmitted teacher but you haven't been to the conference before, they have this ceremony called a Dharma Heritage Ceremony to kind of welcome you in, which is pretty sweet. And there were 24 people being welcomed in, including Susan and me. Rosemary did it before. Was it 2 years ago or 4 years ago? 4 years ago. Uh-huh. And so we have this ceremony, which is pretty elaborate and pretty wonderful. And there was one part that was particularly moving to me, which was at the beginning of the ceremony, we're led into this little room, six at a time, by chosen bays. She's the abbess of a great vow. And there were pictures of six teachers on the altar, and we bowed to them. And the teachers were Tozen Akiyama, Koben Chino, Dainin Kadiri, our teacher, the founder of this center, Jiyu Kennett, Taizan Maizumi, whom I've been talking about, and Shunryo Suzuki, Tim's root teacher. So it was so wonderful to see Katagiri up there, and I really value that moment to sort of express my gratitude to him. And it was interesting seeing him on that altar with those other teachers and seeing all these other teachers in the background, Bodhi Dharma and some other smaller photographs and things. It really reminded me that Katagiri was part of this great network of teachers. You know, we kind of tend to think of him as our guy, and I tend to think of him as kind of, well, what he did once he came here, you know, that's the stuff that matters. But he taught for years in California, and in Japan, I think, before he came here. And I talked to so many people who said, oh, yeah, I knew Katagiri. He taught me in San Francisco. Or, oh, I've been to your center. Sure, I was back there in 78 or something like that. So that was nice because it really brought home to me what a great network of teachers there are. You know, sometimes we feel like, well, you know, maybe we're a little isolated here. But there's this big network out there. And I met so many people, and it was great. And, you know, there's some pretty small towns in California, and they have really active Zen communities, and sometimes more than one, like Sebastopol. Sebastopol, which is in Sonoma County, has 7,000 people, and I think it has several Zen centers. I couldn't turn around at this conference without bumping into somebody from Sebastopol. In California, I think Zen, and some other places, Zen has kind of moved out of the cities, and it's kind of permeating other parts of the state, kind of moving into small towns. That's going to happen here. I have very little doubt about that. And I think we'll be part of that. I think we'll have a role to play. So that's a bit about the conference. But now, back to my big question, why was it refreshing? It didn't start out that way, because 3 or 4 days before I went, I had all of this stuff to do. I had to wrap up these things at Zen Center and at home and at work. I had to iron my robes and pack them. That takes some time, you know, and try to fit my stuff into that little suitcase. Then there was the flight, which was delayed for an hour on the ground, and the shuttle out to Great Vow. So I arrived with a bit of habit energy. You know what Thich Nhat Hanh calls habit energy, that sort of forward-propelling energy that prevents you from resting, because even when you could rest, you're like, oh, I got to do the next thing, you know. So I was kind of oriented toward the next thing. I have to do the next thing. And when I arrived, of course, everything was new, and I had to learn the logistics of everything, and I wondered just how things were there, and I wanted to do everything of correctly, and I wanted to be a properly humble Zen teacher, but I also wanted to be a properly confident Zen teacher. So, you know, it's a fine line there. And I wanted to do every single part of the program because, you know, I need to take full advantage of this. So I was really busy Wednesday evening and all day Thursday, and Friday morning. And it was Friday afternoon that things turned. So, shocking confession here, I took the afternoon off. I just took the afternoon off from the conference. I told myself, I said, you know, Donin, because out there I'm Donin, you don't have to do every single thing. And you don't have to come home from this thing tired or exhausted. You can take care of yourself a little bit. You can do that. So I did. So I took a nice long walk into the Jizo Garden and went further into the rainforest and saw these incredible things out there. And I found a stone bench that kind of overlooks the valley. And I wrote in my journal for a long time. And then I think I took a little nap. And then I worked on my practice period talk a little, but that was fun. It didn't feel like work. And at the end of the afternoon, I was just kind of walking, and I saw this place where there were like these 6 rocking chairs. And I just sat down. I said, I'm just going to stop. So I just stopped, and I sat down in this chair. And I was just doing absolutely nothing. I wasn't even rocking. I was just sitting in the chair. And then my roommate came by, and he said, can I join you? And he sat down next to me. And then some more people came, and pretty soon we had 6 or 8 people there. And somebody came by, and they said, rock on. So, yeah. So, and ever since that, you know, it's strange how things can just turn. Ever since then, I've had all this energy, early morning to late at night, and I've been enjoying the things I do. So what happened there? What happened there? A lot of it is really not that mysterious. I mean, for one thing, I just got some rest. This is pretty simple. I slowed down. You know, rest is so important, and it's hard for a lot of us sometimes to get enough. Some of us are just going all the time. We have so many responsibilities, and we have to work hard. And sometimes we keep ourselves kind of wired up, and we've got our little devices, you know, that we fill every second with, and it's kind of hard to rest. And sometimes we think we have to just keep pushing ourselves. Even in practice, sometimes we think we have to just keep pushing ourselves to do this practice properly. We have this saying, I've heard this saying, it's something like when the body gets tired, and the mind gets tired, the ego gets tired, you know. So you really keep pushing it, and maybe something's going to happen. And there's a place for that, but sometimes there's just nothing like a good night's sleep or a nice nap. And it's not always possible to successfully schedule rest. You know, you may schedule rest and the time comes and you're too wound up. So I try to listen for those times when it's like, wow, I could rest now. I feel like resting. And try to rearrange things and grab a little rest that way. So we have those inspiring words from inside the grass hut. After eating, I relax and enjoy a nap. And a second thing that helped me, it's also not very mysterious, was good nutrition. They fed us good, healthful food. We'd have hot cereal for breakfast. We'd have soups usually for lunch and dinner. And this bread that they made there, this bread was so good. Wasn't that bread good? And about, yeah, different kind at every meal. And for me, I know that there's a very close connection between good nutrition and a sense of well-being. And when I sit a lot and I eat a lot of raw foods and really good foods, I'm like unstoppable. So why don't I do it all the time? That's the theme of this talk. And the moral is, do it all the time. Why not? And a third thing that contributed to my feeling of well-being, I think, was that I had shaken things up in my life. And everything was new to me simply by leaving what was familiar and getting on this plane and going to Great Vow, where I had never been. Everything was new for me, and so I had to approach everything in a fresh way. By going to this conference, I was willingly submitting myself to the unexpected. I was willingly giving up some control. Some of you may remember my talk on temple jobs a while back. I think maybe it was a couple months ago. I talked about how taking on a volunteer job here at Zen Center or somewhere else can be a great help to your practice, because you're willingly taking on something that's a little outside of your comfort zone. You're willingly throwing yourself into the unknown a little bit. We need to do this. We need to sign up for things sometimes, even though we think maybe we're not quite ready. Otherwise, we don't grow. So finally, I'm sure that meeting and talking to and getting to know all those people was important to my feeling of being refreshed as well. I learned so much about what happens at various Zen centers, and it's just fascinating to hear how they're so much like us and so different from us at the same time, and that there are so many different ways to be a priest. So there was that sense of connection to others. You know, sitting in the Zendo at 6 a.m. with about 100 other people, kind of a profound experience, participating in that Dharma Heritage ceremony. There was a part at the end where all 24 of us were kind of in the middle in two columns, and everyone else was on the side kind of facing us. So it's kind of as if you were all the experienced people facing in, and then in front of me, leading back past where Paul is, there were two rows of us. And so we were separate like that. And then there came a point at the end where we just merged into the crowd, where we just kind of moved over to the side and kind of joined those people. So I just walked in, and they said, well, here, stand here, you know. And I was down on kneeling, and it was really killing my knees to kneel for a long time. And somebody saw that, and they passed up a Seiza bench to me so I could save my knees. And it was really sweet. It was a very meaningful moment for us. And there was hanging out with my friends from here, which was really fun, coming out of the Jizo Garden one day, and I just ran into three folks, Rosemary and Susan and Marcus, and was like, oh, home, folks from home. So we were laughing and having fun and being irreverent. You know, reverends love to be irreverent when they get together. Another shocking truth. So when you feel that much support from others, you can also feel that everything you are doing is for others as well. Beings are numberless, vowing to free them. That's what it's all about. That is the ultimate refresh for our practice. I'm not doing this for me. I'm doing it for all beings. So it doesn't matter if it's tedious. In fact, it might be better if it's tedious. Bring on the tedium. That will just be a better opportunity for me to serve all beings. And I got to tell you that that feeling of connection to others was reinforced by what happened after the conference. I caught a ride up to the Seattle area along with Susan. It happens that Susan has a daughter in Seattle and I have a son in Seattle, so we both went up there to visit our kids. And my son Dylan and his wife Corey, I'm happy to say, are expecting a baby in 1 to 2 weeks. I'm going to be a grandfather again. talk about a reminder that we're practicing for all beings. You know, it's just automatic. You know, if you have a kid, there's nothing like parental mind, except perhaps grandparental mind, taking care of others. You can remind yourself of this, and it will refresh your practice. So, doing it over and over and over may sometimes be tedious, and we have to accept that sometimes because it's part of the deal. But doing it over and over also can be fresh and alive and vital each moment. We can cultivate that freshness. I got some rest. I got some good nutrition. I shook things up, so my response to the world had to be new. I felt the support of the Sangha, and that reminded me that my practice is for other beings. So, that's it. Refresh your practice. Take care of yourself, challenge yourself, and look outside of yourself over and over and over and over. So, that's it. Thank you so much for listening. And we have a little time if anyone has a comment or a question.
Yeah, I was going to radio Japanese,
but
instead, I know when you talked about diesel, I was kind of thinking about this low speed garbage down from Japan to the ocean near my place. Yeah, we do have those things actually literally all over the place. You know, I'm so used to it, I don't pay attention. And now you're saying, yeah, you know, we have those things. And in fact, my daughter, she's the one who kind of got us to come here. She does little jingle in her room.
Right.
I remember when she got it. She must have done it when we went back to the bed.
Right.
Yeah, it's just a little thing.
Yeah.
Kind of a character looking.
Right.
No, we have it a lot.
So it's very common to see a little Jizo altar or maybe a big one just like on a sidewalk and, or beside a road or something like that.
Yeah, maybe 2 feet tall. And, I mean, old people actually literally pay attention to, like, putting a, bit of a...
Yeah.
And there's a really famous folk story that, the old man who sells hat, it's kind of like some grandma. He couldn't sell anything, so he was very poor. And on the way back home, he saw a black cousin Jesus on the side of the street covered with snow. Cleaned it up and put the hammer on. And of course, the Jesus was going to bring all the money in. it's a very common thing.
Yeah. Could you folks hear that in the Founders Hall? Well, I don't know if I can repeat the story. I might get it wrong the way I got the Japanese wrong, but thank you. Thank you so much for your comment. And Guy.
I want to ask a question. You talked about actually moving out into the countryside. And if you're a Catholic or a Lutheran, et cetera, you have a very strong, well-funded central organization that can actually support at least the initial years of founding something like that. Was there any talk about that at the conference?
There was a kind of a lot of talk about sort of how difficult it is to be a Zen teacher, and very few people make a living at it, and most people have to have jobs. But I just see a lot of people being willing to do that and willing to do what it takes, and it's not easy. People usually have to do both things at once. But I don't think we should just accept that situation. We should think about ways to help fund people who need to do those kinds of things, who are willing to do those kinds of things. Yeah. So... Okay, well, why don't we go on to the announcements then?